You are Locked On Raptors, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hey, how's it going? Welcome to episode number 340 of Locked On Raptors for Wednesday, May 30th. I'm your host, Sean Woodley of LockedOnRaptors.com and RaptorsHQ.com. You can find me on Twitter at WoodleySean. Find the show at Locked On Raptors. We can find links to every single episode. Make sure you're also checking out the Locked On Podcast Network, team-focused shows for all 30 NBA teams. Locked On Fantasy with Josh Lloyd, if you want to do daily fantasy during the play during the finals. Locked On NBA, of course, is going to have all angles of the finals covered, too. And starting June 13th, I think we've figured this out. June 13th, we're going to have the Locked On NBA mock draft like we did last year. We'll start on the Monday of that week and or the Thursday or something. We might wrap it around a weekend, but it's going to be 5 days in a row, picks 1 to 6 and then 7 to 12, all through the 30 picks in the draft. So make sure you're staying tuned for that. It was a lot of fun last year. Mike Schmitz was on last year's episode. Not sure if he'll be on this year, but stay tuned and you'll find out. And if you find a show on the network that you like, please subscribe, rate, review. It's the best way to support the show, yada, yada, yada. I've explained that a million times before. If you haven't done it, you're probably not going to do it, but please take the time. It's very helpful. All right, on today's show, joined by our pal Joe Wolfon. How's it going, man?
It's going all right, man. How are you?
I'm all right. The Raptors, like, sadness is definitely worn off. I'm content now. LeBron made the finals. Disaster was avoided. I don't know. I've just kind of made my peace with it, but I was kind of team it's fine the day after they lost, so maybe that's not a surprise. But the Brian Colangelo stuff has certainly perked my mood a little bit because it's outstanding.
Yeah. I feel like that was definitely what we all needed to just sort of shake us out of whatever malaise we were in.
Yeah.
Because there was all this Warriors, Cavs fatigue, we're going to do this again, so predictable, and I don't think anyone could have predicted this.
No, and just another reminder to Raptors fans of how far the Raptors have come, personnel-wise, front office-wise. Maybe it will come out the Masai Ujiri as burner accounts. I don't know. But I don't think we're going to be finding random accounts slandering, I don't know, OG Anunoby with links and ties to emails and phone numbers of Masai Ujiri or his direct family. Shouts to A. Ben Dietrich for the piece on The Ringer, and also the sleuth work going on from Sixers bloggers right now, where they're trying to diagnose exactly who it is, and they might have diagnosed it as being Brian Colangelo's wife. Whether or not that's something that Brian Colangelo knew was going on makes that all the more interesting. I don't think we've heard the last of this story yet. What was your, before things started to maybe get clearer today, what was your favorite theory as to who was behind these burner accounts?
I feel like Hinkie was probably the best one, because it just seemed plausible enough that was the kind of thing that he would do, and he feels like he's, you know, borderline mastermind enough to pull something like that off. And I just thought that would have brought this whole saga full circle in a beautifully poetic way. So I was pretty into that one.
I think I heard one or read something where someone was blaming Danny Ainge for doing it through The Ringer, ordering the hit via The Ringer, and obviously in cahoots with Bill Simmons. That would have been really fun too. And kind of would have summed up a lot of opinions I have about The Ringer. But hey, Ben Dietrich did an excellent job.
Would those guys have preferred Colangelo to stay at the helm of the Sixers, though? If they want to see the Sixers fail?
That's true. I think the theory I saw was Bill Simmons doesn't want LeBron to go to the Sixers. So he was trying to, you know, sow tension within the ranks there to potentially make that a less desirable destination for LeBron to go. That seems far too elaborate. It makes a lot of sense that it would be his wife, especially since there were simultaneous tweets during his media availabilities, according to some of these blogs. It's just such a perfect, awesome, beautiful story, though, and I want more of it. It made me feel like the DeAndre kidnapping all over again. It was great.
Yeah, it's the perfect modern NBA story, it's crazy stuff. But my favorite part of all of it is the defending of the shirt collars.
Yes!
By far, that's my favorite detail. Because, I don't know, for years I just feel like it's been a really niche joke, clowning on his gigantic shirt collars, and I would never have assumed that that was something he would be sensitive about. But apparently he is, man. He, you know.
If you're sensitive about it, just maybe don't wear the collars that high. I don't know. It feels like an easily solvable problem. A not easily solvable problem are the Toronto Raptors, of course. And, you know, we've talked about some of the players on the team so far in these player reviews we've been doing, and they've been mostly positive so far. I think we've waited to get to some of the negative ones till later. We did Serge Ibaka, so that was the depths of negativity, I suppose. But today's edition is going to be a positive one, I think. And it is Pascal Siakam. And Joe, I can think of no bigger Pascal Siakam mark than you to have on the show to talk about Pascal Siakam's season. So let's dive into just sort of, we'll kind of go the same format we've done for these before in the last couple weeks. Thing about Pascal Siakam's season that most impressed or sort of made you feel good inside?
Yeah, just the vast leaps and bounds improvement in his ball handling ability, his passing ability, and the overall refinement of like this very raw skill that was on display last year into resembling a modern NBA forward. Mm-hmm. Things that, you know, I never could have predicted for him this season, I don't think. And him looking just like a completely different player this year compared to last. I just think so much was there that I didn't see. And I think there were ways that I could have seen him improving this year, and he improved in ways that I didn't really foresee. So it was pretty cool to watch.
Yeah, I think the way that sort of he sort of lingered in the minds of a lot of Raptors fans was a guy who started 38 games kind of by necessity last year because Jared Sullinger, the answer at power forward, got hurt. And then sort of like kind of just dissipated away from the team and was in the G League essentially during the playoff run. And yeah, I think most people coming into the season, like if I was ranking the bench guys or the young guys as to like how important I thought they were going to be on the team, Siakam would have been on the lower end. Like he would have been behind like Poeltl, for example, and even like DeLon for sure. And, you know, he comes out in like game 4 or 5 of the season and puts 20 up in a quarter on the Warriors. And it's like, oh shit, like this is a thing now. What do you remember from that game? I remember I was driving home from somewhere and was in the listening on the radio in the car as Siakam was going off. And I was like, is Paul Jones just like got a name wrong here? Like, is he totally like on point with this call? What was your sort of recollection of that game? Because I think that was sort of the game that introduced the new Siakam to Raptors fans.
Yeah, it definitely was. And I think that he got DNP'd the game before. Like, mm-hmm. At the start of the season, he was not really in the rotation. He played, like, garbage minutes, I think, the first couple games. Got DNP'd and then came out in that Warriors game, and Valanciunas was injured. So I think Ibaka started at center that game.
Mm-hmm.
And again, yeah, he was not really a guy who I was expecting coming into the year to be like a rotation piece. I think we were kind of thinking, you know, Serge was going to be the starting power forward, and maybe CJ was going to get some run as a small ball four in closing lineups. Maybe OG would get some time at the four, but like it was tough to see where Siakam really factored in. And then suddenly that game happened, and that third quarter happened, and the thing that definitely stuck out to me, he hit 2 threes in pretty quick succession.
Mm-hmm.
In between this like transition run out where he caught a lob and threw down a pretty nasty alley-oop dunk off I think a feed from Lowry, and all that just happened in the span of like 2 minutes, and the threes were the thing where I was like, whoa, he can do that. and it kind of turned out that he couldn't.
Yeah.
But just seeing that he was like willing to shoot those threes and like looked a little bit fluid doing it, and that was something that he at least teased that could be kind of part of his expanding offensive arsenal, was a bit of a shock to me. Like seeing him run the floor and bring that energy wasn't really a surprise, but the way that he seemed to be harnessing that kinetic energy into something functional was pretty eye-opening.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the threes, and I think, oddly enough, the thing that got me most excited this season, despite Pascal shooting like 22% from deep, was every time he sort of geared up to take a three, because it was just like, oh, he's working on it, and he has the green light, and yes, maybe that's problematic at points, and like he's going to shoot them out of some quarters at times, but I was just, like, totally here for Pascal taking as many threes as he possibly could. He had a game where he went 0-5 from deep against the Knicks, like, and I'm like, yeah, that's cool. Like, keep shooting him, man. Get better, because as sort of Zach Lowe alluded to on his podcast where he was talking about this early in the season, like, if he can add a three-point shot, the sort of ceiling kind of gets blown off for him because of all the other stuff we've talked about, the improved ball handling skills, which, you know, the second most exciting thing for me, maybe the most exciting thing for me from him this season, was him just, like, dumping off passes to Jakob Poeltl kind of in new and ingenious ways every game and just finding new ways to get assists that way. I mean, this is a guy who had 4 6 assist games this year, averaging, like, just over 20 minutes a game. Like, he's got real playmaking chops, and the games where he was putting together these 4 or 5 assist nights, like, there was just, you could not help but just sort of be blown away by the potential he was flashing. Where do you think, like, the ball handling figures into the Raptors going forward? Because, like, he was sort of a bit member of that second unit, even, you know, alongside DeLon and Fred. Like, he wasn't asked to handle the ball all that much. Is that something, like, going towards next season that you'd like to see him maybe get more of sort of a burden of doing? And it might, you know, there might be growing pains there because he's not totally refined and the turnovers are still kind of there at times. But, you know, he's also got just, like, really good vision for a guy of his size. And I feel like if there's some sort of kernel of potential there, I feel like you should try to mine that for all it's worth.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much further you really want to take it. I think there are ways you could ramp up his workload and try and involve him even more in the offense. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, like, he is probably going to be playing with two ball handlers, at least while he's on the floor, right? Like, whether that's Kyle and DeMar or whether it's Fred and DeLon, I feel like there are going to be pretty rare instances where he's out there and is, like, going to be relied upon to be, like, a primary playmaker. Mm-hmm. But just the fact that he's able to do it, it, like, opens so many more things up. And I feel like, you know, the kind of Warriors model right now, things that they've managed to unlock, just by virtue of having five playmakers on the floor at one time, are really instructive because, you know, it's not like you have to force feed him the ball and, like, ask him to go and make a play. It's just the fact that if the ball happens to find him, then he's going to have the confidence and the capability to do it. And I think where that developing 3-point shot is really going to come into play is once he nails that down, because I'm just kind of expecting him to do it, it's going to open up so much more for him as far as being able to make plays off the catch and, like, attack closeouts. Everything's just going to be a little bit easier for him, I think. And right now, it's difficult because defenses can ignore him. And when he's catching the ball and his defender is sagging, like, 15 feet off of him, you know, it can be tough to figure out what to do. But, you know, to his immense credit, he actually, I thought, became really good at, like, using that space to his advantage and getting, like, a bit of a runway and just driving right into the chest of some of these defenders that are playing off of him and either finishing over him, like busting out that spin move, or you know, just managing to, like, drive aggressively enough that he can draw a help defender and make one of those stuff off passes. The intuition that he showed, I think, even when put in those difficult situations where it didn't seem like there were many options, he would always manage to find one.
Yeah, man, those little push shots, those were a nice little sort of counter he had to situations where teams would lay off of him. I think, though, we kind of saw it get exposed a little bit in sort of high-leverage games. I think we saw in that Celtics game late in the season in Boston where they lost. He was in crunch time, and it didn't go very well. And even in the playoffs, like, I think, I believe if I, like, I don't have the number in front of me, but because I'm so sick of pulling up the numbers on NBA.com, and the numbers are rattling around in my head somewhere. But, like, I believe he had the worst crunch time net rating of anyone on the Raptors, and, like, that sort of goes in line with the lack of shooting and the sort of the ability of a defense to sort of take that into account and maybe direct their attention elsewhere. And, you know, maybe that's less exposed in sort of the middle parts of a game or on a Wednesday against Orlando, but when you get into the sort of crunch time aspects of things, like, that becomes more of a liability. So I do think that is sort of a limiting thing on in terms of his, like, total upside is the 3-point shooting. And like I said, 22% this season on 132 attempts. it's not great, and like it's as smooth as the jumper can feel at times. Like it's just it's not falling so far. What you said that you're just kind of assuming he's going to do it. What makes you so confident that it's going to happen for him? And you know, if it doesn't happen, how do you see the Raptors sort of working around that?
I just from everything I've gathered, from everything that I've read and heard about him, as far as how tirelessly he works. Mm-hmm. It just seems like, you know, he's already come so far in such a short amount of time that I really, like, I'm not saying, like, for sure that it's going to happen. I was kind of being overconfident for effect, but I just get the sense that he has this kind of untapped potential that he's very determined to fulfill. And it just gives me a lot of confidence that he's going to be able to figure out how to do it, at least passably. Mm. And if he can't, I think we kind of saw it this year, right? And the answer a lot of the time was to put the ball in his hands more often. Mm-hmm. Because he was more valuable as a guy who could dribble and make plays than as a guy who was, you know, chilling in the corner, not drawing any defensive attention. So I think that tends to be what happens when a guy isn't an off-ball threat, is you try to weaponize him on the ball as much as you possibly can. And, you know, beyond that, it's just, you know, using him as a weapon in transition. And a lot of those, you know, defensive rebounds that turn into grab-and-go transition opportunities, I think, are always going to be an important part of his game. And, yeah, just continuing, I think, to empower him to be a playmaker, because mm-hmm. he has filled that role, I think, really, really well.
If you had your druthers, how would you want to see the Raptors deploy him next season in terms of, like, his minutes and sort of the role he has on the team? Because, like, as excellent as he was as the sort of dude who could run a fast break off a rebound and just like scream up and down the court and be a monster defensively, like in the second unit, I feel like there's some more utility there for him. And obviously there's like a logjam in the front court, and that is going to sort of dictate things, because I don't see Siakam playing over either Serge or Jonas. But like, in a perfect world, is a move made to maybe sort of beef up Siakam's role for you? Because like, I think I said this near the end of the season, like, I would not be shocked if by the end of next year we're looking at Pascal Siakam as like the third best player on the Raptors, maybe even more than that. Like, just or maybe not best as in terms of like talent or whatever, but just in terms of impact on the team. Like, I feel like he really could have just like a substantial impact in terms of just like the defense always being good when he's on the court, and the offense just always having a little extra jump and maybe being a bit more prone to running and stuff like that. Like, I think his impact could be pretty enormous if he was to be playing, you know, in his third season with some more development under his belt and just with some more responsibility. So, like, in a perfect world, where do you see Siakam's role sort of playing out next season?
I kind of expect him to be the Raptors' best power forward next season, if mm-hmm. he isn't that already. So I would sort of hope that his role would line up with that reality. Mm-hmm. And that he, you know, whether or not he's actually starting or not, I would just hope that he is getting basically a starter's minute, you know, playing like 28 to 30 minutes a game, mm-hmm. And playing in high leverage situations. And, you know, I think just getting more comfortable and confident, like whether or not the team is the same and Kyle and DeMar are here next year, like if the team looks the way that it did this year, like I would really like to see Pascal get some more run and like gain some more confidence and comfortable feeling playing alongside those primary guys, you know, playing mm-hmm. alongside DeMar and Kyle. Like, I feel like him and Kyle could really develop a really nice chemistry, because like I think Kyle's, even though he's not super fast, he's really good at running the break, and I think, you know, he really thrives when he has other playmakers around him as well, because he moves so well off the ball. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would like to see him spend some more time with the starters and be basically used as a starting power forward, because I think that's, you know, in terms of his ability, that's basically where he's at.
Yeah, I wonder about his fit with Jonas. Obviously, in his rookie season, that didn't work out particularly well, but we didn't really see it at all this season. So I wonder how that would work if Jonas is still around. But I do think, like, again, whether he starts or doesn't, that's kind of trivial. Like, I think as long as he's playing the most important minutes in closing games, I'll be happy, because, like, I really do think him and OG next to each other, and like those are the two biggest reasons I think to be excited about this youthful sort of core of the team going forward is Pascal and OG. And like I just think those two together defensively can be just such a terrifying pair. And they didn't really play that much together this season either because they were such, you know, they're so strict with their hockey changes essentially. We didn't get to see that pairing all that much. And like 3 and 4 or even a 4-5 combo against smaller looks, like I think that could be really exciting. And sort of what we've seen in these playoffs is kind of what you want, right? Like dudes who can defend a bunch of different positions. I mean, we saw both of those guys guard John Wall in the playoffs, for example. They were pretty much the two best options on John Wall in the postseason. Those were the two best options for LeBron, as you know, poorly as things went there. I think those guys are the kind of interchangeable defenders and have the size maybe to hang as a small ball 4-5. That might be sort of tricky. It depends on how they, you know, develop as rebounders, and Pascal got better at that this season. But I don't know. What are your thoughts on just like sort of that pairing as something you want to have in tandem going forward?
Yeah, I think those are all really good points. And I was going to say, like, we talked about this a couple weeks ago when we were praising the Celtics. With vomit in the back of our mouths, but talking about just like how valuable it is to have multi-positional defenders who can switch and who are kind of interchangeable. And the Raptors, like, frankly, don't have enough of those guys. I think that's what these playoffs kind of bore out. And those two are definitely guys you can point to who could conceivably be here for a really long time and who bring those skills to the table. Having two guys who can capably guard John Wall or potentially LeBron James or I don't know, Al Horford.
Yeah.
Like all across the spectrum, like there are guys who they can check at every single position, basically. And I think that gives you a lot of confidence about potentially building a defense around them in the future. The offense, kind of another story. A lot will come down to whether OG can continue to be an effective three-point shooter. If those guys can be on the floor together and not destroy spacing, then I think you're in pretty good shape.
I feel like if those two shared the floor together, they'd just be in a constant duel to see who could produce the cheekiest dump-off pass off a drive.
Yeah, no, that too, for sure. And both really good cutters, I think.
Yeah.
The way that OG cuts along the baseline, and I feel like there could be some nice two-man chemistry there as far as just making those backdoor passes. I for sure feel like there is some untapped potential as far as what those guys could bring in a lineup together.
Yeah, I mentioned off the top how the Brian Colangelo thing has made me feel better about stuff. I think just like thinking about OG and Pascal has also made me feel better about stuff, because it's pretty cool that they're both on the Raptors. We could probably wrap this, though. Is there any other parting shots about Siakam that you'd like to throw in? And we didn't maybe get to everything, but we're going to have so much time to talk about all these guys all summer. I don't want to just sort of use all the bullets tonight, but is there anything that you have before I go watch the finale of The Americans?
No, I mean, just to appreciate him and like what an incredible story he has.
Yeah.
How much he's been through and all the work he's put in to get to where he is, it's pretty incredible. And there were a couple really, really good features written about him this season. So for anyone who hasn't read them, Jackie McMullen wrote a great profile about his journey to the NBA. And Arden Swelling at Sportsnet also, with just like some really, really good background and context if you want to, you know, learn more about who he is as a man and the kind of winding road he's taken from Cameroon to the NBA. It's really extraordinary stuff.
So you're telling me Jackie McMullen and Arden Swelling wrote profiles on people that were good?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a hot take.
Stunner. It's great. That's too hot for this podcast. I think that's all we got. Pascal Siakam's really good. He's exciting. We'll talk more about sort of the larger picture stuff with him going forward throughout the summer, because apparently I'm trying to fill daily over the course of the summer. I apologize. I've been a little iffy with the pods this week. Don't worry. I have two coming tomorrow. So stay tuned for that, and that'll be cool. A couple of good guests, and we're going to talk about Fred VanVleet and Jonas Valanciunas, so stay tuned for those. And, till then, Joe, what do you got to plug right now?
Not too much right now. I've got a couple things out. I wrote like a final sort of primer today, just like talking about what the Cavs can conceivably do to give themselves a fraction of a chance in the series. You can read all my stuff at the score. So there's that. I did a French Open preview before that, which now we're like a couple rounds in, but fortunately all the players I wrote about are still alive in the tournament, so it's still kind of relevant. And as always, listen to Pound the Rock, the Score's NBA podcast featuring yours truly and the great William Liu and Joseph Cucciaro, the Italian stallion. I think that's about it for now.
Right on. Make sure you're checking all that stuff out. Pound the Rock is very good. You guys are far smarter than I am, and I appreciate hearing smart people talk about basketball. Please subscribe, rate, review Locked On Raptors on iTunes. When you go to do Pound the Rock, make sure you do Locked On Raptors as well. It's very helpful. It's for its algorithms and rankings and stuff. That's pretty much all I know about that. Either way, thanks so much for tuning in, and we will talk to you on Thursday and Friday, or maybe all Thursday night. I don't know. There's going to be a double shot of episodes of Locked On Raptors coming up soon, so stay tuned for those, and we will talk to you then.